Well, in John chapter 21, in the very first verse, it tells us that Jesus showed himself to the disciples for the third time here, and that it was in this way that he showed himself. He was there at the Sea of Tiberias. This is the third and also the last appearance of Christ after his resurrection that the Apostle John feels so inspired to write about. The first and second appearances of Christ happened while the disciples were in Jerusalem in the southern part of Israel. We have discussed that in the last couple of weeks there, him appearing in the room there with them. But this now last appearance is at the Sea of Tiberias. That's a change of location. That would be in the northern part of Israel. Now, I bring that up because we have to start by at least acknowledging that something prompted their changing location. They were in the southern part, two appearances of Christ. Something happened that kind of prompted them to go to the northern part there. What was it? John doesn't tell us, but Matthew does. In Matthew chapter 28, verse 10, Jesus had sent a message to his disciples telling them to go to Galilee. Leave Jerusalem, go to Galilee. A few verses later in that same chapter, in verse 16, it says, then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed. We aren't told which mountain that was, but the disciples were. Jesus had appointed a specific location to meet. He was specific. Well, what makes a mountain? According to most geologists, what makes a mountain is that it rises at least 1,000 feet above the surrounding terrain. And the region of Galilee had lots of them. In nearly every direction, you would find such mountains. Galilee also had a sea, Tiberias. It's mentioned in verse 1. We would know it as the Sea of Galilee, but it was also called the Sea of Tiberias. Now, what's interesting is that this Sea of Galilee, unlike the mountains, is 695 feet below sea level. Very different elevation than a mountain, wouldn't you say? Very different location then, wouldn't we agree? Jesus told them in Matthew 28 to meet him on the mountain, there at the sea. We begin chapter 21 with the disciples not where they were supposed to be. Jesus gave them a specific address, specific instructions. But they assumed it was good enough just to be within the same zip code. Brings up a question before we really even get into the text this morning. And I want you to think carefully about how you'd answer this one. The question is this: how close exactly should we be to the will of God? Does he really expect us to throw a bullseye every time? Or is it okay to just kind of hit the dartboard? Anywhere is okay with him. I don't know, if it's just the dartboard that he's looking for, well, then is it okay if I just miss the dartboard entirely as long as I hit the back wall somewhere? And if that's okay with God, can I just take my dart and stick him to the ceiling and, you know, kind of wherever I please? Do I even have to be in that room? You have to understand that this is a pretty slippery slope, isn't it? But we're all sitting here going, but does he really expect me to hit the bullseye every time? See, the details of what we find here at the beginning of the chapter almost require us to make a judgment before we go any further. How exacting does God want us to be? What does he expect of us in terms of finding and remaining in his will? Now, before we make it too personal, let's just pick on these guys. Okay? Were they in the will of God or not? Now, most commentators recognizing as a commentator that they have to make comment about this, do so, but most of them either dismiss or excuse the disciples for being at the sea when they were being told to meet Jesus on the mountain. I'll give you an example here. One Bible teacher wrote, quote, "Peter and the disciples were uncertain of what they should do next," end quote. What? Jesus appoints a mountain in Galilee and says, "Meet me there." And they were uncertain of what they should do next? When Jesus tells you what to do and where to go with specificity, are you excused for uncertainty at that point? He's been clear. He's been clear. Another theologian said elsewhere, quote, "Most commentaries consider that the disciples were fully justified in acting as they did on this occasion," end quote. If I may, I'm going to disagree with most commentaries then. I don't think they're justified at all. When Jesus tells you to do something, you ought to do it. If you don't, that's called missing the mark. So, back to the same question we were already asking. How exactly are we expected to behave in terms of the will of God? Should we be spot on or what? What do you think? How careful should we expect a person to be in making sure that they are in the will of God? I think we got a lot of Christians today, at least in my own culture here, who kind of run around assuming that, well, because I'm Christian, I'm in the will of God. Really? 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 And don't let yourself off the hook here. Either God has a will for your life, you know, like a plan that's glorious and wonderful, you know, or he doesn't. Now, we all know better than to say that he doesn't. He created you with a purpose. That's one of the wonderful realities about being in the will of God. There's purpose there. So shouldn't we then be in the will of God, or should we just kind of wander around outside the will of God and rejoice in the fact that we're supposed to have purpose when really our life is not being lived with any inkling of purpose when we're out there? You know what it's called when you're careful to always be in the will of God? Do you know what it's called when you're very, very concerned and very focused on being in the will of God, doing what God wants? You know what that's called? Reverence. It's called reverence. That word is found twice in the New Testament. And in both instances, it means caution. Caution. The first time it's used is in Hebrews 5:7 to describe the caution that Jesus used with regard to being and staying in God's will. Jesus was reverent, extremely reverent to God, cautious that he was in the will of God at all times. The second time it's used, the last time, the only other time it's used in the New Testament is in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. To describe the caution we should be using in regard to being and staying in God's will. We're talking about determination. We're talking about attentiveness. We're talking about reverence. Reverence. So if we take those two instances in which that word is found in the book of Hebrews, we learn very clearly here that as careful as Jesus was to say or not say, do or not do, go or not go, according to God's will at all times, is as careful as we're expected to be to remain in God's will at all times. The disciples obviously weren't there yet. And neither are we. Can we get that out of the way? None of us in here is as cautious as we ought to be. None of us is living life like Christ was in the will of God all the time. None of us is as reverent as we should be. Well, they'll get better at it. We'll see. But will we? Will we? Will we develop greater reverence toward God over time? The disciples at the beginning of John chapter 21 believe Jesus. They obey Jesus. They follow Jesus. But like some of us, they're not being very careful about it. Meet me at the mountain. Jesus says, meet me at 1,000 feet. And where do they go? 700 feet down. Well, Simon Peter, in verse 2, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, and two others unnamed, all disciples of Jesus, they were together, and Simon Peter says, I'm going fishing, and they all said, us too. So, I'm going fishing. Now, this seems like an innocuous statement, benign, right? Harmless. Like, it's not a big sin to go fishing, is it? Well, here's what's going on. A while back in the Gospels, Peter made a statement that found its way into all three of the synoptic Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You find it in Matthew 10, Mark 10, Luke 18. Jesus made a statement. He says, I've left everything to follow you. He says that to Jesus. I've left everything to follow you, which was true, right? Matthew and Mark both record that they left their nets. The Gospel of Luke in chapter 18 says that they left all. They left everything. So I guess that's true. But here's the problem. Their leaving of those things proves here to only have been a temporary leaving. Because now the very things that they left behind to follow Jesus 3 years ago are the exact same things that they're taking up again once they stopped following him. They've gone back to their old life. Exactly the way it was before they ever met Jesus at all. Do you know how easy it is, and perhaps some of us do, to forget just how within reach your old Christless life still is? You've been serving Jesus for years. Don't get too confident in that. One poor, prayerless decision away is your old life that is waiting for you anytime you want to go back to it. Your nets are still there. Your old boat is parked outside. You can go fishing anytime that you want to. Have you really left everything? Have you really left everything? These guys have gotten a little too self-permissive. Now ask yourself if you're a little too self-permissive. Like these guys, do you allow yourself to fudge a little bit on obedience and being in the will of God? Are you as cautious as you ought to be? Because for these guys, next thing you know, they're right back to doing the same thing they ever used to do, which for them is fishing. Might be something else for you. Nobody in this room that I'm aware of was once upon a time a fisherman. But we do have a few people in recovery. We do have a few that have escaped the clutches of sexual sin. We do have a few people that have perhaps criminal activity on their record. We do have a few people who are perhaps notorious for being absolutely deceitful and vindictive and maybe in some cases violent. So it's not fishing for you. But let me ask you, what were you doing before you met Jesus? What did your life look like before you met Jesus? Because it's still right there. It's right there within your reach. So that's where we find them at the beginning of the chapter. And they, that night, caught nothing. Oh, the haunting reality of following Christ and wishing that you didn't. Wishing you could just get away and just do your own thing. Go ahead. It will amount to nothing. 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 See, in verse 3, the last word of that verse is nothing. And it's the exact same word that they had heard Jesus use the night before he died when he said, "Without me, you can do nothing." That statement was probably still ringing in their ears. It was so recent. There you got him going, "Did I not tell you that if you were going to try and pull something like that, that it was going to go down like this?" And there you are. "Hey, children, you got any fish?" That night they caught nothing. No matter how hard you try. No matter how hard you try, your life will never, never be complete without Christ. Never. Those who especially know the truth of that are those who have, for however long, actually had him in their life. If you've tasted and seen that the Lord is good, there's no going back. And if you try to make a break for it and think that you're going to do all right on your own, living a Christless life just like you used to, you're going to find out that it will result in nothing. These guys, they've left the will of God and they've tried all night to prove that they can manage on their own out there. Trying really hard too, because you can imagine that these guys are like really like they're fishermen. They're going to get the job done. And no matter how hard they try, it's just like all they've done is to prove how big of a failure that they are without Jesus. So morning comes and there's Jesus on the shore. They don't recognize him. And Jesus hollers out there, "Children, you have any food?" Of course, he's hollering because they're about a football field away. "Chill, hey, you guys, got any food?" The word "children" there is informal. It's an informal designation. It's like saying, "Hey, guys." Okay. So he's not. It's not a term of endearment, like affection, like we've seen him use it in the past. Nor is it, he's not chiding them. "Hey, you immature fools." Yeah, he's not doing that. It's just a generic greeting. Which is interesting because verse 4 told us that they only recognized Jesus as a stranger. And now here in verse 5, Jesus is only regarding them as the same. Strangers. Hey guys. They don't recognize him. He's not acknowledging them. In other words, their relationship just isn't what it used to be. The Bible warns us that when we try to manage our life in the strength of our own flesh, we are estranged from Christ. You can go ahead and try, and God will allow you to do that. But you are estranged from, they are estranged from Christ. The relationship, the intimacy and the warmth of the relationship that used to be there ain't there anymore. I'll bet some of us have felt that before. Jesus is there, but he ain't close. Like there's a football field of separation between, at least it feels like it. I don't recognize him like I used to. I'm not picking up when he's part of my life and when he's working. I don't see him there, and he's not exactly walking on water to come out and hug me. He's keeping his distance, and the relationship is gone. He says, do you have any food? Do you think that he didn't know the answer to that question? Do you think Jesus is toying with these boys? Do you think Jesus ever toys with you? We're afraid to answer that, aren't we? Do you think he has the right to toy with you if he wants to? Do you think he has the right to do whatever he has to do in your life to get you to think and to see the silly situation you've gotten yourself into? Do you think he has the right to talk down to you? Because I do. There's no one higher than him. He only talks down. It's a testament to the grace of God that he would ever talk across at all. Yet he does, but not here. "You got any food?" He knew the answer to that. He already knew the answer. Why? he knows the answer because he's the reason why they have no food. I mean, if anybody can prevent fish from swimming where they don't want them to swim all night long, it would be him. He's the one that's kept them from catching anything. So he knows they have no food. Why then did he ask the question? The reason he's asking is because he's making them conscious of their emptiness. He's making them aware of their hunger. You got any food? You don't have food, do you? It's been a long night, huh? He's making them aware of their failure. You went out to fish? Are you being productive? Has it been a fruitful excursion for you out there? He's making them aware of their need for help, his help in particular, someone's help, anybody's help. He's creating desperation in them. That's one of the graces of God. When you're outside of the will of God, to so work in your life to keep you from enjoying yourself out there that you're desperate enough to come right back. That's the grace of God to make you barren. It's the grace of God to make life suck when you're not in God's will. So he's making them aware of the fact that they're out of God's will. And it's interesting here when he says, children, do you have any food? That is the word food there. It's the only time it's used in the whole New Testament. There's a particular Greek word that's being used here. It's the only time that you would find it in the New Testament. So I don't know that food is a good translation. I don't know if some of yours might say fish. I don't think fish is a good translation. He's speaking here of something more specific than food. In fact, the term suggests a sort of relish that was, of course, fish-based. So if you think fish spread, okay, like the stuff that they used to make out, we'd go to this place out in Bayfield, and they would sell this cheese spread that was mixed with salmon and fish. It's really good. Put that on crackers. At any rate, Jesus is asking about something specific, something eaten with bread to make an otherwise bland meal a little more exciting and a little more nutritious. And Jesus is asking them if they have that, even though he knows they don't. You being nourished? Is life exciting right now, or is it still kind of bland? Do you have relish to go with whatever you're doing out there? He knows the answer is no. Okay, the long and the short of it is, when you're outside of God's will, Jesus knows you ain't having a good time. You can try and fool yourself into believing that you are. You can lie to everybody around you and try and insist that it's going well. But you in your heart know, if you're not in the will of God, you know that life is terrible. That's why so many people numb it with whatever they can. Alcohol and drugs, legal or illegal, lots of entertainment, lots of movies, lots of TV, anything to help me not think about the reality that I face outside of the will of God and how awful and meaningless and empty I feel right now. I gotta fill it up with something, food or pleasure and sex and... And then the world just keeps going, yeah, keep eating, keep eating. Give you whatever you want. And Jesus is going, you're stuffed and you're still hungry. You've been fishing all night. Is that what you want? You want more? Then fish all day. You can fish till you're dead. You ain't going to catch nothing. So Jesus goes, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. I imagine him, and I can't, this is all just kind of my own imagination here, but I imagine him being kind of nonchalant about that advice. Put it on the right side of the boat. See what happens. Mind you, he's building a fire and cooking fish. Cast it on the right side of the boat, you find some. The right side of the boat. As opposed to the left side? Or as opposed to the wrong side? Cast it on the right side. Yeah, because Jesus is the only one who knows where and when and how to make life exciting. He has told you and will tell you always. He's not hiding his will behind his back. You know, sometimes people, I'm trying to find out the will of God. You probably already know it. I mean, don't try to paint a picture of the God that I'm aware of as one who kind of plays the shell game with you. Pick. Oh, you missed it again. Which hand? He's not playing games. This is the God I know. This is my will. Do it. We're the one playing the shell game. Oh, this one? You know it's not that one. Stop playing games. Go do God's will. I believe God is one who hates it when people misinterpret him and don't get it. That's why he became a man. He's like, quit getting me wrong. Here I am. Make stuff up about me. Jesus is the only one who knows how to make your life exciting. He's also the only one who really knows how to make it shallow and meaningless. Right? Something kept the fish away all night. Guess who that was? Something also made 153 of them swim into the net that morning, and it wasn't luck. It wasn't coincidence. It was Jesus Christ showing seven men that life without him is empty. Empty in contrast to life with him. Has he shown you that yet? How empty and shallow and meaningless life is without him in comparison to how full and vibrant and abundant it is with him. Well, the fish, even fish, are careful to stay in the will of God. Obeying Jesus all night long, staying on this side of the boat, and then obeying Jesus come morning and getting to that side of the boat and swimming right into the net. Even animals have reverence. And it's not just this instance either. God commands ravens to feed a weird guy wearing sackcloth, they'll do it. God commands a donkey to speak, that donkey's talking. God commands a fish to swallow a wayward Christian, he will. God commands all these animals and every species two by two to go and get on a boat. They're there. Animals are obedient. Animals are careful to stay in the will of God. Even animals have reverence. Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 7 says, quote, even the stork that flies across the sky knows the time of her migration, as do the turtle dove, the swallow, and the crane. They all return at the proper time each year, but not my people. They don't know the rules. End quote. What a rebuke to people, humans, who are made in the image of God. I mean, cranes and storks have a leg up on us as far as reverence is concerned. What a rebuke. Isn't it? Aren't you kind of like, how many of you have pets? Me. It's like, I got these cats and they're squirrely. They're just kittens. They're learning. But it's like, they're probably more in line with God's will than I am certain days. Right? I think God even uses them in my life to kind of like humble me. You know? I mean, it's been like clockwork every morning at about 4 a.m. They're on the bed waking me up. It's like, God, control these two. You know, like, get them out of here. Well, I don't pretend to know what's going on in the mind of these seven men here, but I gotta wonder how humbling it was for them to realize that even dumb sea creatures are more careful about staying in God's will than we are sometimes. Even when it requires their life. Those fish obeyed Jesus even though it cost them their life. And it's this verse, verse 6, by the way, that marks a spiritual transition for these guys. They've been in disobedience. They've been out of the will of God. But now they have obeyed Jesus by casting their net on the right side of the boat. And their disobedience is over just as soon as their obedience begins. It's black and white, okay? I want you to notice that the change, the effect of obedience versus disobedience is immediate. And it's profound. Disobedience, they catch nothing all night. Obedience, their nets, they can't even drag them. They're so full of fish. God would love to show you the difference. Jesus invites them to take inventory of the fish. They counted exactly 150. It's funny that that number's in there. Everybody's like, what's the significance there? The significance is Jesus is inviting anybody to take inventory and compare a life without him to a life with him. Which one do you want? Go ahead and count. Count your blessings, right? One by one. Count them. Well, John gets it quick. In verse 7, I can imagine they're all on the one side of the boat and they're pulling this thing in. And John feels the weight and they're starting to pull it above the water, seeing very quickly that it's full of fish and not like debris. Like they're just pulling up, you know, an old junk car, you know. Oh, it's okay, never mind. It's fish. John turns to Peter and goes, it's the Lord. Doesn't take him long at all. He's the first one, by the way, to identify Jesus out there. He knows it's him. And it's not because he recognized his face. It's because he recognized the effect of his presence. He knows that this is the kind of stuff that happens when Jesus is around. Because it happened 3 years ago in Luke chapter 5. Fishing, 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 ain't catching nothing. Jesus tells Peter, hey, let me into your boat. Jesus gets in the boat. He says, put out a little bit from shore. They put their nets down. They catch so many fish, the nets are breaking. The boat's sinking. That was his introduction. And now it's happening again 3 years later. And John's like, this could only be Jesus. He knows what Jesus is capable of. He remembers what Jesus has done for him in the past. And he recognizes that he's near again based on that. And I don't know that everybody has the ability to spiritually discern God's activity in their life, but some people can. If you're not one of them, you'd do well to connect yourself to somebody who's able to. Stay close to those. I mean, if it wasn't for John, would the other six have ever put two and two together? Would they ever have realized the significance of what was going on? John is the one that went, it's Jesus! But what? We weren't even thinking of that. We were just thinking about payday! Well, John is the first one to recognize Jesus' presence, but Peter is the first one to act. He puts on his jacket and jumps in. The word is plunge. Look at him. You got to wonder if at just the split second as he's getting out of the boat, was he trying to walk on water again? Because that happened once. He's like, Jesus! And he's just manic. He needs to close the gap as fast as he possibly can. And he ain't waiting for anybody. He didn't care how uncomfortable it is. He didn't care how silly he looks. There's Jesus. Nothing will stop me now. Truly, he's leaving his nets. He's leaving everything. By the way, I just encouraged you, if you don't have a lot of spiritual discernment, to connect yourself to somebody who does. I would also say it would be good to surround yourself with people who are like Peter and are quick to act. They're willing to do something. They're going to pursue Jesus no matter what. People like that. So the other disciples, then they came in the little boat. They were not far from land, about 200 cubits. That's 100 yards. dragging the net with fish. And then as soon as they came to land, they saw a fire of coals there and fish laid on it and bread. So Jesus already has breakfast going. Now, these guys were explicitly told to meet Jesus 1,000 feet above sea level, but they went fishing 700 feet below instead, right? And Jesus doesn't seem to be bothered about that in the least. That's odd. I think sometimes we expect the very opposite from Jesus than he actually presents. They were supposed to meet him on a mountain. Listen, Jesus knew he wasn't going to find him there. Not those guys. Not those guys. He knew where they'd be. He wasn't surprised to find him in that boat. Jesus knew them better than they knew themselves. And while they were out there on the sea, acting like their old selves, he was on shore preparing them a hot meal. So they finally make their way back there. Jesus says, "Bring some of the fish you caught." Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land full of large fish, 153. The net wasn't broken this time. And Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew. I want you to notice in this entire narrative how little these men had to say. These guys are speechless at this point. Okay? So far, the seven of them have spoken no more than five words collectively. There was the "no" when they were asked if they had any food. And then there was John's impulsive, "It is the Lord." So, no, it is the Lord. Five. These guys are pretty quiet, aren't they? So, none of them have anything worth saying. They've been faithless. They've been foolish. Each one of them has thoroughly embarrassed themselves in front of Jesus Christ. If we knew these men, someone once wrote, we would discover that they were no different from us. And when we get into the presence of the Lord, we won't have much to say either. Perhaps then, more than ever, we'll realize how faithless and foolish and embarrassing we've been to ourselves. Like, there's no room for pride in the Christian life. You know that, right? Like, we do everything we can to just tear that to shreds around here. Like, if you think you're awesome, hang on. We'll help you see you're not. We'd be glad to do that. It's the best thing we could ever do for you. Jesus will. He'll help you realize that. He's glad to do it. Why? Because he likes to. Hey, he does it because it's good for you. He wants your life to be abundant, but it can't be if you're fully yourself. Well, these guys don't have anything to say. I think they're extremely humbled. Not the least of which is Peter, no doubt. This had to be particularly humbling for him. Especially when we remember the last time we read about him warming himself around a, quote, fire of coals. Yeah. The night Jesus died, Peter was warming himself around a fire of coals in fellowship with the enemies of Christ. Remember that part? Denied him? In fact, that's one word in the Greek language, fire of coals. And it's only used twice, right here and John 18:18, when Peter was warming himself around the enemy's fire. So here you have Peter come in, and the first thing he sees is a fire of coals. Last time he was huddled around a fire, he was in denial of Christ. And here's Jesus making an identical fire, going, "Come and fellowship with me now around this fire. Warm yourself by mine. And eat with me. I cooked you breakfast." If I'm Peter, I'm coming up shore just going,
Oh, fire of coals. Are you kidding me? Oh, is he mad? He's cooking fish?
That must just be for him. He's not going to let me have any.
He's probably going to drown me.
Well, Jesus responds by not only cooking them breakfast, but also by serving them. In verse 13, Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. Peter's going, is it laced? Like, is it arsenic in here? I don't. Is it poisoning me? Is it okay to eat with Jesus after I've done what I've done?
I mean, Peter, not only had he denied Christ and all the rest, he was the instigator of this fishing incident, right? He's like, I'm going fishing. One goes, they all go. He's responsible. He's a born leader. It's not, is he a leader? It's what kind of leader is he? He's either leading people away from Jesus or he's leading people to Jesus. I think that Peter is sufficiently humbled here. It's amazing that for all their irreverence and all of their disobedience, all they get from Jesus is grace and mercy. And that's enough right there to shut them up. They got nothing to say. You ever had an I'll never do that again moment? You ever had one of those times in your Christian walk where you left God's will? And even though nothing terrible happened, like you didn't die and you didn't kill anybody, there was no international incident or nothing, you know? It made you sick anyway. So much so that even now, you're still embarrassed about it. Every time you think of it, you're still haunted by it. And all you can think is, I knew it. I knew it. I knew I shouldn't have done that. Peter did. And John did. And Thomas did. And many others have. And you might be one of them. You know what that's like to leave the will of God and be so sore about it. Well, if you are familiar with that, then I think it's important this morning to consider how you typically respond to Jesus in that I'll never do that again moment when Jesus has every right to strike you with lightning, but instead he cooks you breakfast. How do you respond when you're treated undeservedly well? In light of how disobedient and irreverent you've been, do you, like the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 2, despise the riches of his mercy? Not realizing that his kindness is meant to turn you from your sin? Some Christians are going to live the majority of their life outside of the will of God and expect Jesus to cook them breakfast every morning anyway. That's despising the riches of his mercy. You live in deliberate sin and you think that Jesus is just supposed to make your life even better. Other people will leave the will of God, but it isn't long before they realize that they've made a big mistake and that they're going nowhere without Jesus. These are the ones that get back as fast as they can once they have that opportunity to see him and to draw close to him once again in fellowship. People like that grow in reverence. Are you growing in reverence? Do you exercise greater caution at this point in your Christian walk than you were when you first began? I think you should take a look at that. I think that every one of us in here should have an answer to that question, and I think that before the Lord, we need to be honest about the answer we give. Are you becoming more diligent about finding and fulfilling the will of God than ever before? They were. All of them. Each of them. It's interesting because none of these guys returned to fishing after this.
they hung up their nets for good. It wasn't until that morning on the beach of Galilee that Peter could finally say with any permanence, I have left all to follow Christ. Peter's old life was gone. He's done with it. Are you? Are you more cautious today than you were when you first began Christian about doing God's will? Are you cautious? Are you focused? Are you determined? Are you careful? Are you any closer today than you were in the past to having enough Christian integrity to say, I too have left all to follow Christ? Do you revere God? Do you have reverence for Jesus? Well, this morning, Lord, we're in a funny spot because while none of us in here would admit, I think, if we're honest, to having perfect reverence, great caution, Christ-like determination to do all of God's will, I'd like to believe that we're growing in that. Though there are times when we, like the boys in this chapter, go astray, we make a break for it, we go back to our old life only to come face to face with you at a time when we did not expect. And for any of us who have ever found themselves in that position, confronted by the Lord Jesus Christ, not with a sword, but with a blessing, with breakfast, so to speak, whatever it is that we are in desperate need of. When Jesus comes and gives us what we're hungry for, what can spiritually nourish, that which will make our life exciting again, worth living again, when we're met with that kind of grace instead of the punishment we deserve, we have the opportunity of God for our hearts to melt before Him in humility. Be once again restored to fellowship and move forward with greater reverence than ever. It's all part of the process, Lord, of you making us like Christ. Please let that continue. We see how wonderful you have been with the disciples of the past. We pray that you would extend that same grace and that same mercy to the disciples of today. Because God knows we've all gone fishing when we should not have gone fishing.